I watched a film called Thumbsucker a while back. It's a recent film, and I'm sitting there with Amy, and I tell her, I'm like, I'm gonna keep my eye out for the moon, because I'm like, thumb is the moon in palmistry, and I made it a point. Like, it's kind of weird, and I don't know if you guys have seen that movie about this thumb sucking kid who ends up on Ritalin. It's Keanu Reeves is his dentist, and he decides to get the kid to get over his thumb sucking issue by basically doing a meditation. And he points at an image on the wall of a wolf howling at the moon, and the camera zooms in on the moon as it finishes the scene. And it was like moon, 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 like really directly. And that's a case of something where it's like, if after the fact, if I would have made that connection, I would have found that interesting. But I made the connection before I saw the movie that maybe this is about the moon, and then boom, it like zooms into the moon like as a point. And just really fascinating. So you could take under my thumb to be like under my moon. It's kind of interesting because that's like the idea of Altamont. I've related to like a moon ceremony, whereas Woodstock was a sun ceremony. You get where I'm coming from?
Well, there's
Well, I
also
mean.
another movie about called Gimme Shelter, which is about a about basically about the girl who jumps to her death that started Rosemary's Baby.
Really?
It's about a starving girl on the streets looking for a home. The new Gimme Shelter movie.
I'm not familiar. Yeah.
I haven't watched it, but you should watch the trailer. It's interesting.
Huh.
The musical choices in the trailer are also very interesting.
Yeah, no, I was recently blown away by The Visitor. I finally watched that, and that was really, really loaded with some sync, for real. Relating to Rosemary's Baby specifically, it's kind of like a combination of various movies in one movie. It was like they wanted to run with some themes that were going on, and Rosemary's Baby was definitely one of them. Kind of like a mix of The Omen and Rosemary's Baby, and maybe, I don't know.
Is that the one with Shelley Winters?
Is Shelley Winters in it? I don't know. I mean,
Is
this
that
is.
the one, is that the movie Mark was talking about
Yes.
a couple weeks ago?
Is Shelley Winters in that? That's good.
I think so, yeah.
That's a good question. I should have caught that. If I didn't, I wasn't really. I guess I wasn't paying as much attention as I thought I was, if that's the case.
Because there's two movies called The Visitor, and the one Mark's talking about, I think, is the one from the 70s.
Yes, Stridulum or something like that. It's got another title too.
Okay. Yeah, I've been wanting to watch that ever since I heard Mark talking about it, and especially when I found out that Shelley Winters was in it, because she's definitely some sort of mother figure in all these things I've been looking into.
Okay. At the beginning of your last blog post, what was the deal again with her? Tell me again, because it escapes me.
With Shelley Winters?
Yeah, well, I mean, you go through the thing where you're like you're connecting that Peter Sellers did a version of a Beatles song.
It was one of those posts where I didn't know where to start, which I'm sure you guys are familiar with the feeling. It's like, where do I dive in? I don't know. So I just figured I'd start with that because I see Peter Sellers and Shelley Winters as these mother and father figures of sort of like a, I guess you could say like a star child, a moon child, a golem. I mean, they're not all the same thing, but I guess they're like in a weird way you could kind of lump them all together. And so I started with that because I go into A Hard Day's Night later on, and I'm just trying to make connections between Peter Sellers and the Beatles because Peter Sellers, he's in Lolita and The Magic Christian. Where he adopts Ringo in The Magic Christian, even though he's like in his 30s, he adopts him because he wants a son. So I had to tie in, I had to show how Peter Sellers was inextricably linked with the Beatles. And then I got into Shelley Winters, and all the different ways she connects with, not necessarily the Beatles, but like Roman Polanski and Kubrick.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, you're correct that Shelley Winters is in The Visitor. I'm looking it up right now.
Okay, yeah.
She's lower
in,
on
in
the...
In the movie A Place in the Sun, someone tries to kill Shelley Winters in order to marry Liz Taylor. And so that's the same Lolita plot again.
Oh, yeah.
Where
oh,
James yeah. Mason tries to kill Shelley Winters to marry Lolita.
Oh, one thing I forgot to mention was Shelley Winters in Lolita, she gets hit by a car. She gets killed in a car wreck, and it's by the Beale kid, B-E-A-L-E.
Mm-hmm.
This, yeah. Like, Lolita's friend, Johnny Beale or something like that.
Yeah, just and
it's just
the
missing
Christian
a T
cross.
And a B Beetle, you know?
Yeah, it's missing a Tov. You know what I'm saying?
I didn't hear what you said.
It's missing a Tov. It's like Beetle without the Christian cross.
Right. Or the Tov.
That's interesting. Yes. And so you have this repeated, you know, Beetle wreck phenomenon where, you know, Vitri, I keep forgetting her fucking name, but the girl from Rosemary's Baby who lands on the white Volkswagen Beetle where John Lennon was killed. But then you have like this, you know, in Poltergeist, you have this Beetle that gets flipped upside down right when the house gets sucked into the vacuum, you know. And then you have, and I have all these correlations between The Shining and the Poltergeist, which I'm sure you guys are aware of. And then you go into The Shining and you have this upside, or is it upside down or is it just crushed? This crushed red beetle. It's like, it's a repeated theme. And the amount of Volkswagen beetles in these Sharon Tate films is kind of uncanny. It's really strange. I mean, I was just tripping out. On you know, you did that video, Patrick, on the Can It Be Any Other Way deal, where you're taking Superman and you're looking at Superman as the Ubermesh and connecting it to 2001: A Space Odyssey, and that the song "Thus Spake Zarathustra," referring to Nietzsche, is the same notes that occurs in the Superman theme with Christopher Reeves, and how odd it is that like the most valuable comic book that exists is that Action Comics, where Superman is the first Superman, where he's got a Volkswagen Beetle raised above his head, which he's crushing, and how, you know, the first people to ever drive Volkswagen Beetles were the Nazi elite, you know,
well,
before anybody.
The 1980 Death album is Scary Monsters and Super Creeps. And that's a deliberate reference to Bowie's song, The Superman, back in 1970. So.
Interesting.
It's all connected, man.
It is. It's totally, man.
But the super creeps part is important.
Right. Huh.
Yeah.
Since we created this kind of like masculine image of the Superman god form as like our Jesus character, and that's something else that needs to be destroyed.
Totally. Yeah, well, it's also this kind of, like, triumph of the will kind of thing.
Right, this guy's called kind of fascistic Übermensch type.
And wasn't that Nietzsche's sister that pushed that? She was a Nazi who ended up, like, she's just a total fascist. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Like, yeah, something like that.
Yeah, and I find that so interesting that you have, like, you know, the head of the psychology department of public relations was Freud's sister, and then Freud's nephew was, you know, working on the exact same lines. He was extremely, probably admired more than anybody by the Nazis.
Riefenstahl, another one of those Teutonic twats.
Yeah, I mean, it's so weird that, it, like, Edward Bernays, and I forget Freud's sister's name, and then you, like, it's like these people who are not, they're like blood related to the people who are making these, like, they have really important work. And like, fucking Nietzsche wasn't a fascist. Like, his perception of the Übermensch, from what I gather from everything I've read, it's not a type of Nazi ideology. It doesn't come across that way. I don't believe that was his intention. But yet it got used that way by his sister. In the same way that Freud's ideas, as much as I disagree with a lot of them, you know, like, it wasn't Freud that used those to manipulate the masses, it was his family. And in fact, Freud wouldn't even be known in the U.S. hardly at all if it wasn't for his nephew publishing him here, you know, and he's came up with the term public relations, and admittedly, like, in interviews has said that it's just another term for propaganda, because the propaganda got a bad rap, you know. And so I don't know, I find that really fascinating, that it's these people's family members that do what was done with their interpretation of these different philosophies. It's kind of interesting.
Well, yes, that's the whole thing with taking your Jesus and then twisting him into some kind of evil religion.
Yeah, and I mean, that's
turning into false prophets.
Exactly, and that's like the
Paul's
argument.
Paul's dead and all that, you know?
Totally, exactly. Well, what the fuck, right?
Each is dead, Paul is dead, God is dead.
Yeah.
Dillinger is dead.
Huh.
Have you seen that film?
No. I what are you referring to? Dillinger?
There's a 1969 film, Italian film, called Dillinger is Dead, and it's pretty good. Well, it's about this guy. He finds a gun in his apartment wrapped up in newspaper, and the paper is, the headline on it is about Dillinger dying in like the 30s or something. But anyways, the biggest thing I saw in that film was that after he kills his wife, who was played by Anita Pallenberg, the girlfriend of Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, I believe. But anyways, he kills his wife, and then he goes outside to his car, and it's parked next to a red Volkswagen Beetle.
Huh. Scary.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a popular car, but it's the specific ways in which it lands and specific things that is kind of curious, for sure. I mean, it'd be one thing if it was just one, even if it was the one in Rosemary's Baby that's covered with blood, if that was the only fucking Volkswagen, but there's four Volkswagens on that street in that scene alone, and then they reoccur, and then, like, even when she's looking at the book to see how to kill someone through, or to take someone out using magic, you know, I forget whose book that was. Was that Wright? You know, it's Wright or Waite. What's his first name? Waite?
Arthur Waite.
Arthur Waite. I think that was an Arthur Waite book that they're looking at in Rosemary's Baby, if I recall correctly.
Probably.
Yeah, but it's giving
ceremonial magic, perhaps.
Yeah, it's giving the formula for how to take someone out using magic and taking one of their personal possessions and all of this. You look over his shoulder, and there's another white Volkswagen Beetle. Like, it feels fucking strategic. Like, I can't help it. I'm just like, what? Like, come on. And they all happen to be white. You know, it's kind of ridiculous.
Michael Antonioni films I was telling you about, like Blow Up and Zabriskie Point and The Passenger, starring Jack Nicholson. Antonioni uses Volkswagen Beetles a lot in films too, and it seems very strategically so.
Is it just another Sun reference? Is that the deal? Is it just because Volkswagen VVV VAVAVAV is like 666 and therefore the Sun? Like, you know, what's his name? The main warlock. I want to say Cassavetes, but that's the actor. But he's got a similar name. That got the
Cassavet.
Yeah. When he's saying goodbye, and he watches it with the White Album, and they're playing the Good Night. You know, now it's time to turn out the light. You know, the sun is about to. You know, whatever. And he's waving goodbye and getting in the taxi. And how weird it is that you're saying goodbye to 666, the sun. And then they're saying goodnight, sun, basically, like goodbye, sun. You know, it's. And then they happen to fucking point the traffic director close up on his hand, points to the exact spot where John Lennon's killed, right when the album is just finishing. It's pretty ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah. Goodbye, sun, and hello, moon.
Yeah, and is that like what the orange is all about? Like, because I know, like, you know, I watch The Trip. with what's his name, the Easy Rider guy,
Dennis Hopper.
Yeah, Dennis Hopper.
And Peter Fonda.
Yeah, Peter Fonda is holding the orange, and he's describing it as the sun. Do you remember that when he at the beginning of the film when he first starts to trip and he picks
I haven't seen it yet.
He picks up this orange and he's like remarking on how it's the sun. He's holding the sun in his hand, is what he says, and it's like orange sun, like trying to it's like trying to drive that point home. And so there's this reoccurring orange deal. It's really weird. Like, with Oh Lucky Man, with the fucking orange written on every single monitor around the room, you know, and he's checking his, the director's checking his watch.
Yeah, stopwatch clock.
It's like clock and orange, like, as direct as you could possibly get. It's so fucking weird.
Right. And then you've got the main character's father... Is Burgess?
Yeah, everything. I mean, that's an example of like where to start between the correspondences of Oh Lucky Man to A Clockwork Orange. It's like there's no fucking end to it. It's like I just want to just say, just watch it, just watch the two back to back, and you'll see, you know, because it's absolutely ridiculous. I feel like any I'm surprised I never heard that before until just recently. Like that seems like something that would be a thing. You know, that, like people would talk about. It's fascinating. And I'm surprised that movie didn't get more, I'm surprised it took me so long to hear of that, because it's a fucking fantastic movie. Oh, so, yeah. So good. One of the best movies I've ever seen, and yet I didn't hear about it till this year. What the hell?
Yeah, it's kind of the ultimate film for sinkheads.
But even beyond Sinkheads, it's just a fucking great film.
Oh yeah, I love it. I love the whole actors playing multiple roles.
Yeah. So how many actors in A Clockwork Orange are in Oh Lucky Man? I think I counted
five. Well, you've got Grady and Dim.
Yeah, but there's more. I feel like there's more. I feel like I saw some people that I recognized in smaller parts. I thought that I'm probably wrong, but I thought that the woman who gives him the who gives Alex the test where she's showing the different pictures, I thought I saw her in it, but I could be mistaken. I mean, I know she was in a John Lennon film, How I Won the War.
Yeah, I don't think I saw her in A Lucky Man, but there is a nurse in A Lucky Man who's in Help.
Okay. Is she the one who first, when he first shows up in the facility, who comes up to him?
I think it's the lady that comes around with cookies and coffee when they're in the military base.
Yeah, like that. I mean, it would be really difficult to actually research that to the point because there's so many small little roles in both films for different people. Like, I didn't even know. I'm like the woman who's. Getting it on with the doctor when Alex is in a coma and she runs out and she's topless. Like, I'm just saying, there's like these small little parts. I wonder how many of those small parts actually show up in the movie. Cause it's I don't know. It'd be really hard to research that to find out, you know, cause there's so many actors in both films. It's just ridiculous. So
I thought it was great that his love interest is played by Helen Mirren.
Who's in Caligula?
Yeah,
with Malcolm McDowell, and she's the queen in The Queen, and she's the voice of Deep Thought in Hitchhiker's Guide.
Yeah, and she's in 2010.
Right. Yeah, that's really so. What? Okay, so you watched 2010 recently?
Yeah.
What was the deal with her? It's been so long since I've seen 2010. What was Helen Mirren's deal there?
She was a Russian astronaut, and she kind of, her and Haywood Floyd kind of butt heads the whole time about decisions and what to do and what not to do.
Okay. Once again, what was the deal with, I saw that you had posted an image of the sign-off date, but basically Haywood Floyd's... I think you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah, Haywood Floyd filed his report on the Discovery mission on December 9th, 2001, which is ironically, the day David Ames starts his dream life in Vanilla Sky.
Right. And so if you know then that, you know, Vanilla Sky's usage of not just Beatle references, but specific Beatles references relating to the Rosemary's Baby sink. I mean, he lives at the Dakota. You know, he walks out and there's someone wearing a Revolution No. 9 shirt.
All right. So again, there's that thing where John Lennon is David Bowie because it's David Ames. And so that's the insanity of the whole thing.
Yeah, or David Bowman, which are the same thing as far as I'm concerned as well. Like, that was something that seemed to be kind of established there. Very weird, because you have, you know, the bow and the Ames and, like, you know, the arrow. That's why I wanted you to see that sink so bad. Not just Eye of the Devil, but specifically with Abbey Road and what actually takes place in that. When you started at Sharon Tate's title, because it, like, I saw you commented the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, All Good Children Go to Heaven, which was on the door of the Manson family before Abbey Road was ever released. And so,
and David Niven is feeding Sharon Tate in that scene. When right.
Yeah, All Good Children Go to Heaven. She hasn't been a good child. It's fucked up. Like, you see.
And she's whipping him because, I mean, he's whipping her because she tried to get Deborah Carr to walk off the top of the building, and she was supposed to be Novak who was doing that from Vertigo.
Yeah, and then, you know, in God. Vertigo, Novak does jump off of a tower.
Right, at San Juan Bautista. And so, actually, when I was a kid, I went there, and there was a point at which you could walk up to the top of that tower, and they had closed it off right before I got there. Shortly before, it was like the week that I showed up at San Juan Bautista, they made it so no one could climb up there anymore, because it is, like, it's a rickety ass kind of unpredictable kind of thing, you know. It's like, anyways, I don't know how that's related other than the fact that I had a personal experience at that place. But yeah, it's weird. And so that's the whole deal in Vertigo, where she's like, this is where I was born and this is where I died. Looking at the rings of the tree, and it seems like there's something happening with, like, kind of like a time loop or a time warp, or something's going on with that. And I feel that that's what the show Mad Men was trying to present by moving through the 60s in real time and picking, like, an anchor point at which to start. Because that's all been, and, like, every year that there's another season, it's a year has actually gone by in real life, and it's a year in the show itself. And so it's as if they're like repeating a cycle, and that there's a cycle that's happening. But I don't know. It's almost like, you know, I don't know if you guys, I know you, Patrick, you've seen my Manson synchronicity with Valley of the Dolls. But, you know, when Sharon Tate walks out and it's saying, I'm just a boy playing the suicide king, and the guy holds out his hand over her head to, like, basically, like, it's an off with her head kind of moment as he's saying that, and how it seems like she's playing the part of the suicide king, even though, you know, Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she doesn't have a lot to say, you know. Yeah, it's kind of hard to explain, but it feels like there's some kind of, like, golden bough archetypal thing being played out with Sharon Tate, where she's almost like the male figure in a way. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, especially, like, the way she's wearing that fucking headdress, man. Like, she's like,
I mean, royalty. Like a male Lucifer figure? I don't know.
I don't know. I feel like she is the sacrifice or something, and that's like the way that it like everyone's relating to it that way, to the point where she's even relating to it that way, not even realizing it. And I mean, I watched Valley of the Dolls, you know, 5 times before it struck me that she's Marilyn Monroe as well. Like, you know, her pill suicide and the way that, you know, who she is and what she's portraying in the film. You know, you have Judy Garland being portrayed by Patty Duke, but Judy Garland's also being portrayed by that other woman. I said betrayed. That's kind of a Freudian slip. but you know,
Judas again.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I find it really strange. What's going on there with this kind of like, who, like the guy who directed Valley of the Dolls was definitely on one. Like he was, there's something going on there and it's suspicious as fuck, you know? So
that movie is really bad though. Like it's the worst, most cheeseballs movie in the world. And I find it really hard to believe that anything in that is intentional.
Really? I don't know. I haven't watched it with sound for the last 10 times I've watched it. As far as the photography of the thing is concerned, I think it has some merit, but yeah, I don't feel that that's a good movie. I'd say Beyond the Valley of the Dolls is a far worse movie. But that's beside the point, 'cause it's a whole different thing. But yeah, no, there's something going on, in that film, that is actually very deep. Like the way that the pills drop at the beginning and you see that it's the snow that everything's covered in, and the way the subliminals throughout that, visually are hard to catch, unless if you're looking at it in a more meditative way, where it goes from the graveyard when she's looking out the window of the train at the beginning to all the kids playing around in the snow and how it's showing you that these are the same thing and that basically everyone's dead. They're also, what's the name of that photographer? I forget. Do I have it here? Man Ray. So that was a point of the film that was pointed out by Marilyn Manson. That you have, you know, this photographer, Man Ray, who's taking these photographs of these women, and they're all supposed to basically be mannequins. They're not, they're like soulless women. And it seemed like that's what they were trying to communicate in Valley of the Dolls, was that these people are basically like hardwired, like they're just mechanical. They're playing something out unconsciously, and they're a part of something that's kind of programmed. The whole thing is about programming, and so it becomes rather obvious once you see that. But that the dolls, as the pills, are also the women themselves, and that's why the people turn into pills at the beginning and drop. There's definitely some subliminal elements at play, which mm-hmm. which give it some artistic value.
That all ties into Ira Levin's The Stepford Wives, too.
Absolutely, which is exactly the same woman who did Rosemary's Baby, did a film about these perfect robot women, right? Who are basically, they just do what they're told, and it's very similar. The parallels are striking. And the fact that Patty Duke then played Rosemary and whatever happened in Rosemary's Baby just only adds to the connection, you know? It's pretty ridiculous.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it was really funny to read your blog, Jason, and to see that, like, I assumed that you were just going to say that as I was reading it, because you're already making all these connections, and then on top of it, there's a connection in the midst of that that's like, well.
I think I kind of did with the Eidolons.
I don't know what Eidolons are.
Doll figures, statues, hollow images.
Mm-hmm.
Superficial things. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's, it's hard to describe this, but you know, with a lot of these things, there's these subtexts that are, I don't think that they're trying to, I mean, they might be, but there's racist elements at play. I think it's more of like a, like kind of more artistic representation trying to communicate of like what kind of fascism or bigotry or whatever is going into the industry is inherent. And so, like, you know, you watch Rosemary's Baby and it's just like, you know, these all these white people who are just living up in the Dakota, you know, and you got the servant, the elevator man, who's just, you know, like, these are the roles that they have. Everyone in Valley of the Dolls is just like white people, white people, white people. And I can't help but like look at the White Album as like a kind of a statement about like, you know, like white American music kind of taking from black culture and doing its own thing with it. And like, I don't, do you guys catch all of that? I mean, there's certain places where it's more overt, like The Shining is ridiculously overt with that, but it seems like there's kind of like an embedded type of subtext of racism and fascism that's like there in the story, that's just like in your face, but it's like so it's like it's so in your face that you can't see the forest from the trees. Do you see that?
Yeah, I see it. I don't know what to make of it really, but yeah, I do see it. There's a film called Zabriskie Point, which is it came out in 1970, but it started filming in 1968. But the crazy thing about it is the first half of the film is about, you know, like racial tension and race riots. And then there's a protest and this black student gets shot and then a cop gets shot. And then the main character escapes. He flees to Death Valley and they have orgies out there. And the love interest in the film works for a development company, and they're trying to build homes in Death Valley for rich white people. Oh. So you've got this like racial tension, and then you've got white people fleeing to Death Valley. And it's like, how come no one has seen the Manson parallels there?
Right. Yeah, immediately. That's just like, it seems yeah. Interesting. Yeah, no, I've never seen the film. I've listened to the soundtrack a lot. And the Grateful Dead and everybody that Pink Floyd that contributed to that. Actually, the last Always Record, I included one of the Pink Floyd songs at the beginning of it.
They have a song on that film called Pig Meat or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's playing. It's playing at the very beginning of the film while these Black Panthers are giving a speech, and the main Black Panther is a woman named Kathleen Cleaver.
Oh,
so you've got like
shit.
A knife playing during Pig Meat,
right? And Pig on the Door, and Pig, you know, piggies. And the thing with piggies is that is like, I cannot believe like the Beatles are so fucking dark. Is there a song on the White Album that's not suggesting bloody murder? Like piggies is like about cannibalism. It's the rich. Mm-hmm. The rich elite who are basically like eating themselves, and like it's so satirical and it's so fucking dark, and like I'm like you know, when you watch it with Rosemary's Baby, it becomes all the more obvious, but it should be obvious anyway. I mean, everything like you know, the Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? And like I hear bungalow 80% of the times that they're saying buffalo. Do you hear that too? Like every time I fucking listen to that song, I'm like, I swear they're saying bungalow. And like, who lives in bungalows? You know, who's fucking, you know, like it's like about like LA actresses or something.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, it's supposed to be about this guy in India who would bring his kill in, you know, and show them, you know, what he had gotten in the jungle, you know, that day. Mm-hmm. But it's like, it's a fucking dark song, you know? And like, mm-hmm. When Yoko comes in and does her whole thing, and it's like the children asked if to kill was not a sin, you know, it's like, what the fuck, dude? Like, yeah. This is the Beatles, like this is like supposed to be the height of the fucking Love Generation, and yeah. There's just this like total focus on bloody murder. It's weird. And like, you know, I watched some documentary, the Helter Skelter deal, and the guy who's narrating it is just like, I don't know, he quotes John Lennon as saying, I don't know what Helter Skelter has to do with murder. It's like, what? Really? You might not know what Helter Skelter has to do with murder, but your whole fucking album seems to be about murder, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, is this not obvious? Does not everybody see this? Like, it's not just a Manson thing. I mean, that's a thing. You know, I mean, he picked up on something. I mean, I'm sure a lot of his interpretations are pretty out there, as are, you know, some of our own, but still, mm-hmm. like there's some very like direct things being communicated there.
Yeah, definitely.
So, you know, I mean, what's, I don't know. What's the deal? Was Meet the Beatles their black album or something?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one that came out the day JFK died.
What song came out the day JFK died?
What'd you say?
What song came out the day JFK died?
The album with the Beatles came out that day.
Is that not their first album?
Yeah, that's their second album.
Oh, what's their first album then?
It's Please Please Me. That's the name of the album.
See, I was confused. I always thought that Meet the Beatles was their first album, but I guess I haven't done enough research. Yeah. I mean, I didn't live through it, too, so that adds to it.
Yeah. And then it's interesting that they came to America through JFK Airport.
In the first place? Yeah. Huh. Weird.
And the first song on with the Beatles is It Won't Be Long.
Oh, shit. Huh. All right, you guys. Well, I don't know if you want to keep talking or what's going on with you.
I don't know. I had a quick question about something you mentioned at one point about the about Lilith being born from the flaming sword. Like, I wasn't sure, like, the fullness of that.
Huh. Did I said that at one point? Was it, did you read that in my notes, or?
I think I read it and you mentioned it at one point, and I was just wondering if there was any sort of expansion on that or not.
Yeah, well, it's not in front of me, but yeah, from what I remember is that there's this idea of the flaming sword is literally flipping this way and that's guarding the Garden of Eden. And so I guess in a sense that's related to intellect, which cuts things apart, you know. So it's literally like dicing up reality, so to speak, and or splitting reality, which is splitting the tree. And so in a sense she takes on the role of what's keeping the tree divided. And so the extrapolation is that she is the flaming sword, which is also likened to what's standing before the middle pillar, from what I remember. So yeah, it's kind of interesting too if you think about the idea that she's literally sucking out the life breath of the thing. So it's kind of communicating that if the life breath is the thing that's you know, giving us our spiritual sustenance, then for something to be taking that from the distribution, you know, that's what the flaming sword is communicating, because it's literally what's keeping the exile in place. And so the handmaiden then is keeping the exile in place, is the idea, at least from what I gather.
And that Look What Happened to Rosemary's Baby film, the handmaiden is the daughter of Minnie and Roman.
Uh-huh.
Like the Lilith character, and she steals Adrian's demon to make her demon baby.
Right.
Which is also what apparently happened to David Bowie in the 70s, where he was afraid that witches were stealing his semen.
Was he now?
But he was on a lot of cocaine at the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he probably did more blow than just about anybody, maybe, with Jack Nicholson excluded.
But it's interesting because that movie came out in the 70s.
Oh, whatever. And in it, he's like a
glam rock character.
Uh huh. Yeah, I mean, I found it really interesting.
It's 1976. It's Station to Station era David Bowie.
Huh.
At the same time that David Bowie was worried that witches were stealing his semen, Look What's Happened to Rosemary's Baby is about a glam rocker in 1976.
God, you're right.
Who gets seduced by Lilith.
Wow. Yeah, my favorite scene of Whatever Happened to Rosemary's Baby is in the discotheque.
Yeah, and like that guy, his best friend is named Peter Simon. So there's the whole Peter dagger again.
Huh. Interesting. Hmm. Yeah.
In The Tenant, the previous tenant that jumped out the window, her name was Simone. And one of Polanski's friends in the film is named Simon.
Hmm.
So it's like a female Simon, basically? Samoa. Well,
Roman Polanski is Dom Cobb, right? Sure. Yeah. The Rose in exile after their wives get killed.
Yeah, and he jumps from the window.
So is the deal with Cobb that it's like a Osiris reference via the corn?
Like, yeah, I would guess so. Yeah,
corn god.
Well, Inception, it's weird because you've got Maul kind of resonating Malkuth, but then you've got Ellen Page, who should be the second Hay as Malkuth, and so you've got some kind of water and water mix up there.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, you go. You go ahead.
I was thinking of Malcolm McDowell. You know, like a dowel is a wooden peg. Kind of like a wooden phallus. And in a Britannia hospital, he gets Frankenstein. He gets cut up into pieces and like put back together with other people's body parts.
Oh, so he's kind of like Osiris in that case then, huh?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, that's a lot to process. I've yet to see.
Look what's happened to Rose Baby. Also came out on Winona Ryder's birthday.
Oh, really?
She was born in 1970 and not 1976.
Huh.
I think.
That's interesting, Beetlejuice. Yeah, no, I have yet to watch Beetlejuice with the white album.
1971.
That's supposed to be another good one, right, Patrick?
Oh, Beetlejuice and the White Album?
Yeah. You were telling me I need to watch that, and I still haven't. Isn't that... I'm sorry, is that Winona Ryder? That's Winona Ryder, isn't it? In Beetlejuice? Oh, you're missing a lot of what I'm saying. I think it's recording. I
can hear you now.
I think it should be fine in the recording. I don't know what's going on there.
Okay.
Well, I guess we'll see. But Winona Ryder is in Beetlejuice, right? She's the...
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Just making sure I'm not being confused. So, okay. Now, John Cusack, another JC, he's born on the day and year that Rosemary's Baby is supposed to be born.
Yeah.
So how did you calculate?
John as JC? So again, that's that little hint there that John and Jesus are the same person.
Yeah, totally. Well, that I think that James and John are literally the same person as well, and that they're two sides of the same being, which is Yeshua.
King James.
Yeah, totally. That seems to be the joke, and that's what I keep coming back to.
Well, if we want to sum up all of this up, I think it goes back to Philip K. Dick's statement that all of history is about one immortal man who always learns.
Yeah, or Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces, right? It's the same principle applied, that you have this single character that's
right. So these masks. Various rock stars seem to be different, but they're really not. They're all just faces of one sort of redeemed Lucifer figure.
Yeah, I mean that's what
redeemed
I took,
Redeemer.
That's what I extrapolated from Eyes Wide Shut, and that was the point of the masks, and that's why, you know, in Vanilla Sky, he's got this mask, and he's like so, you know, deformed underneath it. It's that all these people are like basically wearing this mask of this character. But behind it, they're not. They're a twisted version of the archetype, and none of them are the archetype ultimately itself. So they're like kind of like a mutilated depiction of the thing, and that would make sense if you look at the idea that the Klipot are literally a reflection in the mirror of the Tetragrammaton, but none of them are the Tetragrammaton. They just...
Well, yeah, that's the whole labyrinth mask ball again, where you've got the self, and then you've got all these sort of masks around it.
Yeah, it's like that they're playing these different roles, and behind what it is that they're portraying, they're only a twisted representational model of the thing, and not the thing in and of itself. And that what they are has to eventually, you know... allow for its own demise, and that's necessary to move on from what's being projected. That's the world that is to come, so to speak, right? I don't Yeah, it's very strange. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I feel like artistically and symbolically, like that what's being communicated is something very old that's been trying to be communicated over and over again through whatever means we're able to communicate, and it's utilizing kind of a dream language in order to get us to understand, or to get themselves to even understand. I feel like they're working things out for themselves as much as they're trying to portray what they know as insiders to the masses, that they themselves don't really know. And it's just kind of like turning around a Rubik's Cube to try and like basically destroy itself, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Did you see I dropped in the chat? There's an actor in The Tenet that looks a lot like John Cusack.
Oh, yeah.
Which is weird because he was just a kid at the time, but there's this adult actor in there that looks a lot like him.
Interesting. And so Joan Cusack is another JC too, and they're in so many films together. It's really weird. Gross Point Blank, obviously, and Say Anything, and there's a ton, right? They almost seem to be portraying kind of like that they're two sides of the same figure as well. It seems like a common theme. They're named that way. I haven't seen The Raven yet. I've been meaning to watch that John Cusack film about the Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven. Have you seen that? Did you watch that?
No.
I watched Hot Tub Time Machine for synchronicity purposes, and I had to turn it off, actually, just because it was so bad. But I was on a tip at that point where I was like, John Cusack is playing a Christ figure, and let's just watch this and look for a hint. And then there was all these, he was moving out of an apartment, and he had all of these boxes that had red stickers on them, and he just sticks a sticker on his forehead, like as a bindi. And that was enough for me, and I turned it off because that was in like the first 10 minutes of the film or something, or the movie. I shouldn't call that a film. At that point, I was like, okay, there you go. I found it's over. That's all I needed. Thank you. because Krishna, Christ, it's the same root, right? Mm-hmm. So, Christos. So you had, I was wondering if this was an idea that you had just extrapolated, or if you had actually read somewhere that the White Album was meant to basically represent the history of American rock music throughout the whole. Could you elaborate on that a little bit, Patrick?
Oh yeah, the White Album, it's pretty much like a pastiche on not just American rock music, but sort of all of Western pop music going back to like vaudeville. It's sort of like the nail in the coffin of everything that came beforehand, and it kind of chopped it all up and put it back together for, you know, a new genres to be spawned off of from that.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's not just a plug on the 60s, it's like a plug of all of history leading up to that point. It's like sealing the deal, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I feel the same way about Rosemary's Baby, and I feel the same way about Altamont, that they're kind of this, like, and Ken Kesey's statement at the time, where he was like, no more acid tests, this is over. You know, and it's like, what the fuck? You're getting all your LSD from Tavistock. You were asked to distribute acid. Now you're the one telling us it's over. Like, you know, what the hell? You know, very, very suspicious, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went to the same high school that Ken Kesey went to. And he spoke there my senior year, and he told everyone to drop out.
Yeah. That's
so awesome. And he was never asked back after that.
Yeah, I imagine he wouldn't be, right? That must have been great to see him give a little talk. That must have been really something.
Yeah.
But I have mixed feelings on Ken Kesey big time, you know. I mean, I know that I've listened to his recordings at Stanford Hospital when he's being tested with MK Ultra and stuff, and you know, it just sounds insane. Like, what I take from that is just that they had a different conception of the way that the public would, what they would do with LSD. I don't think they thought that people would actually organize, and that was the purpose of getting everyone on it, was that, how perfect, like, just keep them in their kind of, like, eye-popping, you know, Clockwork Orange kind of, like, hypnosis, you know, and not really be able to do anything, and then people were actually able to do something on it, and that didn't correspond to the hopes and wishes of the power structure. At least that seems pretty apparent, but I don't know.